Because up here we grow.
Yeah.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order on this beautiful February 23rd.
It is beautiful.
We've got a few public hearings that we're going to start out with. So we're going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2804.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure limits the number of hours that nurses employed by the Department of Corrections may be required to work, and it creates an exception to it. And it applies to collective bargaining occurring on or after the effective date. You do not have any amendments before you.
Great. Let's call up Dane Kosnick. Looks like Nancy, but I'm going to say it's Mary Buchan. And we'll start off with those two. Doesn't it look like Nancy to you?
It does.
You're just saying
I'm
that.
Just saying that.
Good morning. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll go ahead and start if that's okay.
Perfectly fine.
And I tried to write more clearly this morning, but I'm going to buy you new glasses. For the record, Mary Botkin, and I'm here this morning representing Oregon AFSCME and the nurses that work in Oregon's prison system. We're here supporting House Bill 2804. It was introduced at our request. With me is Dane Kosnick, and Dane is from Coffee Creek, and the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville, and he is a nurse there. You have my testimony, so I won't read it. I think you can read it just fine. But I think it's important to understand the background on this legislation. Currently, if a nurse works in a private sector hospital, there are limitations on how many hours they can be forced to work within a week or at a time. Those limitations are important because of the critical nature of their work and the fact that patients depend on their accurate work in caring for their illnesses and disease. Those protections and those limitations do not apply to nurses who work in a correctional facility. Unfortunately, the nurses working in a correctional facility face even more stresses and even more regulations, and it's more difficult for them when they have to work double shifts. And unfortunately, because of staffing levels, our nurses are being forced to work doubles on a regular basis, and that should never be the case. Inmates tend to be litigious by nature and look for reasons to file lawsuits. And having nurses working double shifts creates an environment where if errors occur, it can result in litigation and lawsuits by inmates, which may or may not be successful, but are certainly distracting and time-consuming and additionally stressful for the nurses. But with that, I'd like to have Dane go ahead and do his testimony, and then I will assist in answering any questions you or the committee may have. Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
I'm Dane Kosnick. I live in District 35. I'll just read what I have. I'm a husband and father of one living in District 35. I'd like to thank our representative Doherty for her work on this bill. I work as an institutional RN with the Department of Corrections. I've been at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for 5 years. I take pride in my service to the state and enjoy the daily challenge of working with the difficult population that the ODOC has to provide. During the majority of my time, mandates have been used only in emergencies, lockdowns, riots, and disasters. And in this type of emergency, I'd fully expect to stay and help. But this last year, mandates have been used to fill posts during normal operations because of lack of staff. Being mandated like this is difficult for a number of reasons. Firstly, it happens far too frequently for some shifts, and the vast majority of our mandates have been happening to those nurses who work on night shift. After arriving at 9:30 p.m., they stay awake all night, and then they get to work a second very, very busy day shift and do two more medication lines, which increases their risk for having medication errors. Personally, I work an evening shift and have been mandated onto night shift, where I find it very difficult to remain awake and alert enough to provide proper care. And the problem with mandates is that even though I know that I could be mandated or I'm near the top of the list, it's really possible for me to plan for because I don't know that it's going to happen. I still have a life outside of work. I have to wake up and play with my son and do all this other stuff, spend time. And then I get to work half my shift and find out that, oh, you get to stay another 8 hours after you're done. And then it could be 23 or more hours before I get to sleep. I then get home, sleep immediately, and then wake up 7 hours later and go right back to work. So I don't really get to go home, essentially, or see my wife or play with my kid. And then the next day, I'm still not really rested because sleeping during the day is not my norm, and it's not really a restful time period for me. And I think this bill is important because it brings the Department of Corrections nurses up to the standards of nursing in the private sector and protects us from, and our licensure, from any harm from doing 16-hour days. We're not prepared for it.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Pretty concise about what your issue is. Questions? Representative Evans.
I just have a very brief question. I think it's covered, but I want to clarify. The exceptions, and I please understand from where I'm coming from, I get the argument of regular shifts. Mm-hmm. But during time of an extraordinary emergency or during time of a seismic event when keeping control of public facilities is critical, these exceptions are sufficient for that? Or is it something that we need to look at just to make sure that during a time of major surge operations that can happen? Not day-to-day, not monthly, but if there is an event where you need to stay, I just want to make sure that we don't have you in an impossible situation.
In those events, like I don't know how you really plan or word for that stuff. It'd be sort of, if I was at the facility and there was an earthquake, I think there's like 17 bridges that I go over or under. I don't think I'd even be able to make it home in a seismic event. So, of course, I'd just stay.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, Mary Botkin, for the record. It certainly was not our intent to stop nurses from being mandated when there is an emergency situation. And, you know, I don't believe that this bill would stop that from happening. Okay. It certainly was not our intent to reduce coverage in an emergency.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many times in the last year have you worked a 16-hour shift?
I've worked two times in the last year when I've been mandated onto a 16-hour shift.
Okay. A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. Was that... were you given the option, or was it you will do this?
Yes, you will.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
I guess on that, isn't there a call list or anything that they would go down for seniority for offering that time out?
So how it works for us at Coffee Creek is it goes voluntary overtime list, which is just like posted on the wall, you write your name in. We'll call anyone on that list. You offer it to part-time people. We used to have a vacation relief person who you could call, but they just accepted it a full-time, so we don't have anyone else to call. And then you offer it to staff on the floor for voluntary, and if no one takes it, it's then up to mandate.
So it's after the list is all lists are exhausted before you mandate.
But sometimes, like, not very many people want to sign up for day shift overtime because you have to be there at 5:30 in the morning, so it's not really like the greatest to wake up that early. And so if there's no one on the list, it falls on to the people who are there. And then if it's a night shift, there's only three people there, and typically it just goes to night aid.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So, and then when it goes to mandate at that point, you've had it happen to you twice in a year.
Mm-hmm.
How many other people have had it happen to them, and do you know the amounts that it's happened to other people?
I know there was one night shift nurse who actually left the department. Happened to her twice in a week. I don't know exact numbers for the other nurses, but I know everyone on my shift, evening shift, has been hit at least twice this year. I know I'm next.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, we can find, I just made a note, and we'll find out for you for sure how many folks have been mandated over the last year and for how many times.
So, if I may.
Thank you. Another follow-up?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yep. The only reason, because I'm hearing twice in a year, Mary, and I'm just, to me, that's not exorbitant because I come out of working in union plants where when we have a shutdown, you work 16-hour days during that shutdown because we have a limited amount of time to get things done. So, I mean, if something happens, somebody calls in sick, these kind of things happen, and we have to be flexible with it. So I just want to make sure we don't paint ourselves in a corner here or paint management into a corner where, especially in a prison situation, where we're left high and dry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, the problem is that this is a staffing issue, and it's become a consistent problem. You know, it may not happen to one person over and over, but it's happening to a lot of people systematically. And it may very well be a recruitment problem, that nurses can make more in other settings, and so it's more difficult to find people who are willing to work in a very challenging environment. And it happens more frequently in rural areas than in the urban area, but we will get you some hard numbers on that, about how many nurses are being mandated and how many times. And you know, it's my experience that these kinds of issues do not rise to the top of people's list of complaints unless it is a consistent and reoccurring problem for folks.
Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mary. As far as bringing that up, that was going to be my question, was how does this nursing occupation in the public sector meet up with the private sector, you know, as far as pay and the requirements that are in the private sector for this same scenario? If they were missing someone on a shift, can they mandate? Is that optional? Do they have people that volunteer? Is the overtime the same, you know, wages in the public versus the private? And just that comparison, you know, so we could see how this job compares with something at a private hospital.
The average pay, I just happen to have this. I got this, actually I got this online.
I knew you would come prepared.
The average pay for a nurse in the private sector is $71,000 to $93,000 a year. And the average pay, or the current pay for a nurse okay, so I don't have that. It is about 45 to 59,000 in the public sector. And in the private sector, they consider the nurses about 6% under market. So even at the much higher rate, it's still 6% below market. So even in the private sector, they're having problems retaining nurses. And, you know, you put nurses in a prison environment where your client base is sicker and have more health problems. You know, it shouldn't be shocking to anybody that our client base in the prison system is not a client base that spent a lot of time with preventative medicine when they were out of prison. So, you know, they're sicker, they need more, and they're more difficult to manage. You know, Dane works with in a prison filled with women, and while one might think that they would be easier to manage, it is my experience that they can be, in some ways, not only different but more difficult in some ways to manage, and they have more health issues, and certainly different health issues, and so it can be very challenging for them. And if you look at the testimony from Annette Skillman that is online, Annette works in Pendleton at EOCI. She's not a nurse, but she works with the nurses. And her testimony is pretty compelling about what the nurses are facing over in that area. And you just, you know, you multiply the problems based on the location. Folks who work in Lakeview, for instance, you know, there's not a big pool of nurses just waiting to come in to the prison system to work. So it is very challenging for folks.
Follow up. Do you know if the in the private sector, if it's mandated, you know, some of these same rules? I mean, do they have a 12-hour limit like is being proposed here? Do they have a double shift limitations?
I believe that I believe that Jack Dempsey is going to be testifying, and he represents both public and private sector nurses.
Okay. Thank you.
See Jack.
He was here and just stepped down.
Oh, okay. He's not here. He was here a little bit ago.
Mr. Chair, I'm tempted to answer the question because I do this for a living.
Oh, yes, you can.
So, another question, Representative Nose.
I would just say that this law, that's this bill that's before us, is a law that has been operationalized in the private sector setting now for a long time, and for the most part, it has worked pretty well. This part of the law has, because it does pretty much put a limit on how much an employer can require a nurse to work. So it's worked pretty well. It can be a little more challenging in smaller facilities for obvious reasons, but it's generally been a law that's worked pretty well for us. And there are exceptions spelled out in that law for, like, emergencies.
Thank you. Not seeing anyone else yet to testify, so thank you very much for your testimony this morning. There is actually other people to testify, but your lifeline in Jack Dempsey is not one of them, according to my sign-up sheet. So with that, thank you very much. I'd like to have Christine Popoff.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
No, so it's part of my job, so you can enforce the contract.
Good morning. Thank you for testifying on this bill. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
So, my name is Christine Popoff. I'm the Assistant Director for Human Resources for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Good morning. And thank you for giving me this time this morning. House Bill 2804 limits the number of hours registered nurses, licensed practical nurses and certified nursing assistants employed by DOC and working inside correctional facilities may work. This bill attempts to bring nurses who work for the DOC in line with nurses employed in private sector hospitals as governed under OAR 333-510-0045. Nurses employed inside DOC correctional facilities do not work in a setting exactly comparable to that of a private or public hospital. They treat incarcerated men and women housed within a correctional setting, which requires strict adherence to security processes and protocols, namely tool and medication controls. A failed tool count may result in an immediate lockdown, during which staff may not exit a facility until the lockdown is lifted. Unlike OAR 333-510-0045, House Bill 2804 does not allow for exceptions due to emergency or unforeseen situations, such as inclement weather or lockdowns, nor does it recognize the risks specific to working within a correctional facility and with adults in custody. In addition to the realistic potential of a lockdown, there are the risks of a riot or hostage situation, which would greatly increase the demand for medical response and would likely result in the need for overtime. House Bill 2804 does not provide exceptions in these types of situations that restrict the department's ability to inefficiently respond to emergency demands and provide the community standard of care. The use of temporary and/or float pool nurses is a strategy the department already employs to address staffing challenges related to overtime. However, this option is limited in its effect and its effective application, as a nurse from outside the agency still needs to be trained to provide medical care inside a correctional setting and must be vetted through additional security screenings. Passage of this bill would require these nurses to report in times of emergencies. Moreover, this option is specifically limited in those areas where populations are smaller and medical care may already be difficult. It may be a difficult demand to meet. DOC's inability to mandate overtime will impact our ability to relieve staff for training and other job-related activities. In addition, this bill may impact approval of requested time off outside of any time scheduled through the vacation bidding process. The restrictions to overtime will also inhibit health services' ability to offer flexible scheduling, something several nurses have routinely asked management to consider. All classifications of staff working within a correctional facility are bound to the requirement of being available to work during emergency situations, up to and including mandatory overtime. Given the circumstances under which mandatory overtime is unavoidable, it is likely medical services will be essential. Absent any exception language, the language in the bill is too broad for the department to adequately staff health services in times of emergency, crisis, or unforeseen circumstances. The department is sensitive to the amount of overtime nurses are required to work. We are committed to providing a high level of medical care for adults in our custody while doing our best to staff health services in a manner to encourage and allow for healthy life-work balance for our staff. Staff wellness is our number one priority as a department, and mandatory overtime is part of that. We are very aware of that. Removing our ability to mandate overtime will have a significant fiscal impact to the DOC and impact our ability to respond to emergencies inherent to working in a correctional setting. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm curious if there were clearer exceptions for true emergencies in your setting, like a lockdown or a natural disaster, would that kind of amendment make the bill more acceptable to you? Because I'm guessing most of us probably think that requiring a night shift person then to work 8 hours over into the day shift seems like a really bad idea.
Thank you, Representative Nose, members of the committee. Chair Holvey, certainly amendments would be helpful to this bill, depending on how they're written and what the language looks like. I know that we are willing to continue a conversation with AFSCME around that. That said, the exceptions need to allow for the community standard of care to be continued to be provided. And as noted by Representative Widener, mandatory overtime is a last option. It's where we find ourselves when we've exhausted all other opportunities to fill the position without requiring somebody to stay. So certainly exception language would be beneficial to us. And the reality is we get there because we've exhausted other options.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up.
Is
one of your options the ability to contract with a private nurse staffing agency and see if they can send somebody in?
Yes, Representative Chair Holvey and the rest of the committee, thank you for the question. We do use float pool nurses. The challenge with float pool nurses is that some coming in and providing medical care in a correctional facility is different than going into a hospital or a doctor's office. I think Mary Botkin spoke to that eloquently. So the challenge is getting somebody who is trained in that operation in that setting. So the difficult part is a temp hire or a float pool nurse isn't exactly equal unless they've already worked there, been vetted through our processes, and are aware of the protocols that are required in a correctional setting.
Thank you. I'm curious, does the Department of Corrections budget request more FTE for nurses to help alleviate this situation, or is that above your pay grade?
No, sir. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, in early fiscal review, I believe Health Services has identified a minimum of 20 FTE that would be required to make this bill as written even reasonably possible. I just received information from our Health Services Administrator, so please forgive me for consulting the phone. He indicated that, as Ms. Botkin said, we do have 28 vacancies department-wide right now. 12 are being held for vacancy savings, and 16 are recruitment. We're trying to recruit for those. So we do have some current vacancies. There's also challenges around FEMLA, OFLA, extended leaves, those kinds of things. So
to answer my, I guess, follow-up on my own question there.
Yes, sir.
So the Department of Corrections budget proposal that's in Ways and Means includes more FTE for these positions, or you just have enough positions that are just unfilled that haven't been filled yet?
We are staffed to, Chair Holvey, I apologize, members of the committee, we are staffed to what's called a minimum staffing standard. So anything that would be above what we need now would require FTE, and it would be part of a fiscal impact statement for this bill specifically were it to pass for those 20 FTE to be included to cover, or at least to be reasonably able to cover the language of this bill.
Let me rephrase this. Do you know if the Department of Corrections budget requested more FTE for these nurses?
I do not know, sir.
Because it certainly seems like this would be an appropriate discussion and AFSCME would also be interested in weighing in on in the Ways and Means process to help alleviate some of this problem. Or if it's just simply a matter of not being able to recruit nurses to go into this position, you know, that is a whole nother problem as well. So I don't know what the answers to these issues are at this point, but just, you know, some things that are popping into my mind. Representative Barton, a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Chair Holby's comments, it just seems odd that this is one of those bills that here we are as a committee seriously contemplating, and in a sense, nobody wants it. The underlying nurses don't want, they probably lament more than anyone that this might be necessary. The union probably views this as a last resort. Mm-hmm. The department certainly doesn't want us to do this. We probably don't want to do this. Like, it seems everyone's interests are aligned here. And so my question is, how long do you think it would be reasonable for this committee to wait and see if the DOC changes things? Do you think a few months? If a year from now, if this problem hasn't changed, then we. How long do you think it would be reasonable for this committee to give the department before we stepped in?
Vice Chair Barton, yeah, and Chair Holby and the members of the committee, I think that's a very good question, and not one that I am comfortable putting a finite mm-hmm. answer to. I can tell you, as I said earlier, it is the number one priority for the Oregon Department of Corrections staff wellness, and mandatory overtime is part of that wellness issue, both in terms of life-work balance, sleep disruption, and what it does to people's lives outside of work, not to mention their ability to focus and contribute effectively and be successful inside that environment. It's certainly something that we have at the forefront of our mind, and it is one of those necessary evils in the business that we're in, where you cannot telecommute to provide medical services to an inmate. You cannot telecommute to provide supervision on a housing unit. We have to have bodies in position on the ground. So I would hope that filling vacancies certainly would address some of this. And in terms of a time frame, I can only tell you that we're very committed to limiting the amount of mandatory overtime that we need. In talking with Steve Robbins, our health services administrator, it was the very first thing he came back talking about when he traveled around the state. It is forefront in everybody's mind and something we absolutely do not use unless we have to use it now. And we are being creative about finding ways to limit the number of times it happens.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my question would be, because I think we're dealing with a lot of different laws and issues that we have handling prisoners here as well. I'm just thinking, I mean, if you didn't have a nurse on staff for 4 hours till another one came in, I mean, is that something that we can do without breaking the law? So that way, let's say you didn't have somebody showing up, because I'm sure there's something happening where someone has to carry over for 16 hours, so you kept them over for 4 hours to 12, and then we just had a lapse of 4 hours with nobody there. Can we do that legally the way the system's set up now, or does somebody have to be there all the time?
Representative Widener, members of the committee, we have various ways of providing health care now. We do have some institutions that have only 4-hour health services care. Anything that happens outside of that time, those individuals are transported to the hospital as necessary. We have 24-hour care, and then we have care that's about 17 to 18 hours per day. So depending on the type of facility we run, we do have times where we may not have health care providers at the institutions, namely the minimums. And in those cases, we, by ambulance, transport inmates to hospitals outside for care. In those facilities that have 24-hour care, it is my understanding we have to staff them 24 hours. So to have an absence or a vacancy in a 24-hour service, that would be the challenge. We do currently have processes in place to operate when we don't have medical services on the ground. Those are more expensive and pose more risk, because anytime you take an inmate outside of the secure perimeter, you do run a higher rate of risk.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Representative Widener's question, the standards of care that you mentioned as being something you're required to provide for inmates, is that a federal requirement, a state requirement? Could the state be sued if they don't do that? What's the answer to that?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, we can be sued. We are sued quite frequently. In fact, medical care is probably one of the most litigated areas in correctional services. And the community standard of care is what health services refers to as the standard to which we are held. Candidly, I am not sure if that is a state or federal mandate. My guess is it's both. So we are subject to litigation, and inmates are sentenced to our care and custody, and we take very seriously our obligation to provide both of those things.
So, and the other question I had was, you mentioned that you have these positions, you have I guess, budgeted vacant positions. How long have those positions been vacant?
That I do not have an answer for, sir, but I can find that out for you, members of the committee.
That would be helpful.
Yep.
I just feel like we have a couple of issues going on here that seem to be associated with your budget and not having perhaps the adequate FTE, maybe, or maybe. It's a recruitment issue, which tells me that if you're unable to recruit after a certain period of time, we don't pay these nurses well enough to recruit people into this position. So, and both of those go back to, you know, having enough revenue, tax money, I will say, to fund the Department of Corrections. So that then becomes a whole nother issue as well. So there seems to be a lot of things going on with this bill. And certainly understand, you know, you're worried about emergencies and things like that too, and perhaps you can work with AFSCME to see if there's some middle ground here on this bill. I'm not sure what it would be at this point, but I commend you for coming forward and having this conversation. I know it's a difficult one for everyone.
Chair Holley, may I add just one more thing as a piece of information for all of you, and I did confirm this with our health service administrator, members of the committee as well. Our nurses do receive police and fire benefit, which means they are able to retire 5 years earlier with full retirement benefits. So that may not be a calculation that you see reflected in the pay. And the challenge with that as an incentive is that generationally speaking, we're not dealing with a group that tends to look that far out in order for the reward to be worth it. And it is something I wanted to make sure the committee was aware they are police and fire eligible, right, and covered.
Yes, I just recognize that, you know, there's lots of people that want jobs,
yes,
out there in the world, and if you can't recruit for this position, it seems there's a fundamental piece going haywire there. So thank you so much for testifying this morning.
Thank you, members of the committee.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2804. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify? I can reopen it if they did. Not seeing any. That I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2805.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure includes base pay of corrections employees of the five most populous cities as a comparable factor that's to be considered by an arbitrator when establishing the base pay for Department of Corrections employees. You have before you a proposed dash-line amendment that corrects a error that it's actually to look at the five most populous counties as opposed to the five most populous cities.
Thank you. Well, can we have up Mary Bakken and Tim Woolsey?
Woolery.
Woolery. Boy, people need to print, I tell you.
Some chairs seem to have more trouble with this more often than other chairs.
That's enough out of you.
Are you going to call on Representative Bonetto today?
I know. I was just gonna say.
No, I've got him down. I practiced all weekend.
Okay, it's Nancy and Woolery.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mary Bakken, representing AFSCME Council 75, and you have my written testimony. I'm not going to walk through that. I am going to talk a little bit about the amendment. There was a drafting error caused by a requesting error to this bill. The person who requested the drafting of the bill requested that comparables be listed as cities. That is incorrect. Cities do not operate jails or correctional facilities. Only counties do. And so we're asking that the term cities in the bill be changed to reflect that and make it counties. And Tim Woolery is with me. He knows. He is our chief spokesperson at the bargaining table for corrections and knows this issue inside and out. So I have nothing more to say. I'll be here to answer questions, and I'll turn this over to Tim if that's okay with you.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Tim Woolery, and as Mary said, I'm the lead negotiator for Oregon AFSCME. I work for the union. Prior to that, I was a correctional officer for the Oregon Department of Corrections for about 18 years. I've been involved in bargaining since about 1995, when a fairly significant change to the PECBA bargaining law occurred. They changed it at that time to have a sort of a winner-takes-all type of an arbitration instead of allowing an arbitrator to select pieces that were reasonable from either party's final offers. They have to choose one entire package or the other, as well as setting out a list of criteria, with the interest and welfare of the public being the first primary criteria for an arbitrator to look at, and then some secondary criteria. The reality is what we're seeking in this change to the law already exists, and practically all of the arbitrations that have occurred since 1995, there have been four in our unit with AFSCME security employees, and there's also been four with the Association of Correctional Employees, AOCE. Either the state or the union or both have introduced county comparators in the arbitration. However, it's not specific. Several sessions ago, the Oregon State Police sought a change and achieved that through this body of adding the five most populous cities to their specific list of criteria. The only thing that this bill is seeking to do is to add for Oregon correctional employees the same, having it specifically listed as counties being a comparator. Doesn't mean that the surrounding states are no longer a comparator. It's just adding specificity and removing ambiguity. So that's the main purpose of this bill, and we urge your support.
Thank you.
The only thing that, Mr. Chair, if I may, the only thing I'd like to add to that is corrections officers who leave the Department of Corrections for other employment generally do not go to other states. They are actively recruited by county employers. And it's really very simple. It's a very simple mathematical equation for county sheriffs. They don't have to pay for training. The state of Oregon has already trained the officers. They already have experience working in the prison system. So moving to a county jail is, beneficial for those county jails. And they actively recruit folks from the Department of Corrections to come to work for them. So, this is just an acknowledgement that is who our who we should be compared to, because that's where our people go. They don't go to California, generally speaking. They certainly don't go to Washington, and they most certainly do not go to Idaho. So, it's just an acknowledgement that that's who our competitor is.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Chair Holby,
could I? Oh, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Elbert. Chair. Almost
it.
Got you there, didn't it? there are some other occupations, if you go and work as an apprentice for a lineman with different companies, where you sign on for several years after that, so that if you go through their program, they have this expense incurred in training you that you're committed to that. Is that true in corrections at all, or is there a penalty if you don't do that, or that one corrections entity would have to pay the other for that training process? Does that make sense?
That does not currently exist. There has been legislation in the past that would require an employer to It would require, if a county took a corrections officer from the state of Oregon and moved and got them to go to work for Malheur County, The legislation would have required that Malheur County reimburse the state of Oregon for that training. The bill did not go anywhere. I mean, but the issue has been before this body in the past in different, you know, makeups, you know.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I bring that up is because over in Pendleton, that was one of their largest complaints, is they train these officers and then they go to a different part of the state where the pay is higher. And so they're continually in this training process, which is costing them a lot of dollars.
I have heard, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Barreto, I've heard this complaint in different makeups over the years. You know, everybody goes to the same place for training. You know, they all go through DPSST, and
they used to.
Well, yeah, corrections receives a little different makeup of training now. We receive, our officers receive training within the department that meets DPSST standards and is more specific to the needs of the department than that of a county jail, but it does not. I would argue that our officers have more training in more areas than a county corrections staff does. You know, when you have to supervise somebody 24/7 for a number of years, the training is different. But be that as it may, they are still highly sought after individuals for county corrections.
Representative Hurd.
This may have been, I was reading, so maybe you answered a question like this. How many employees have we lost to counties in the last year?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we don't have that specific number. When we prepare an arbitration, oftentimes we'll get that information to be able to provide the arbitrator with that type of information, but we haven't had an arbitration since 2009, so the numbers that I would have in my head are probably wrong.
Follow up.
Thank you. Follow up.
Is it possible to get those numbers for us?
I believe the Department of Corrections will be able to assist us. The issue is when someone leaves the department, not always do they say why they're leaving and where they're going, so that the numbers might not be as positive. I know from my tours and my dealings with correctional officers, particularly in the Willamette Valley area, they jettison and go for higher pay at the counties. There's some safety in staying with the state of Oregon compared to counties, mm-hmm. but when you earn approximately $1,000 a month more doing the same type of work, it's hard to stop someone from looking at that favorably.
Representative Evans.
Yeah, just a comment rather than a question, but related to an issue that was brought up having to do with pay of public safety officers and the training costs. There is a bill that if anybody here is interested in working on that is going to try to make it possible for GI Bill dollars, federal dollars, to be used to help offset some of those costs, so we actually have a farther reach for both corrections training as well as DPSST training. So anybody interested in that, it is a factor that relates to every small town, every county across the state, especially emphasizing the O&C counties right now that are struggling to keep their jails open. So just a small piece on that.
Thanks for the heads up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Not seeing any other questions. Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward and providing your testimony this morning.
Thank you,
sir.
Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? There was nothing, no one else signed up? Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2805. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2921.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure authorizes the Commissioner of Labor and Industries to use the Wage Security Fund to administer and enforce laws governing wages, hours, and employment conditions. And there are no amendments before you this morning.
Thank you. Committee, this is a bill that the I brought forward recognizing some problems, and after speaking with Boley about this, thought that this may be something we would want to consider. And up to speak, we have Paloma Sparks. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to testify today in support of House Bill 2921. This bill gives the Bureau the authority to use the Wage Security Fund for additional tools above and beyond their current authority to pay out for employees that have wages that are owing to them, but they have worked for a business that has gone out of business, and so they can't collect on the wages right now. So that's the current use for the fund. We would like to also be able to use it for our administrative needs in the wage and hour division. It's a pretty simple fix. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
What's the balance of this fund? I mean, if the primary purpose was to, as you described, to provide, benefits to people who didn't get their pay and the company went bankrupt, this fund collects money. And so there's actually a balance in this fund consistently that could be used for wage enforcement to bring in more of the money that are owed to workers?
Chair Holvey, that's correct. Right now we pay out, sort of varies depending on what's happening and how many claims we've gotten, but there maintains a fairly healthy balance within the Wage Security Fund above and beyond even our biggest years of paying out wage funds.
Thank you. Questions? No, Representative Widener, question?
Yeah, I guess I'm sitting here thinking about this. You're thinking of businesses that have went under, weren't able to pay wages. Would it be something Bully would look at going after a company that shut down because it went out of business?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, current statute requires that we, after we've paid out wages, we create a lien against the business to try and collect those wages to get the Wage Security Fund to be paid back from the business if possible.
Follow up.
So somebody who's lost everything they had, we're going to lean and put them further in the hole and make their lives even more miserable?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, that is the current requirement in current law.
Thank you, and I think that goes to lien law, where labor is in first position to recover money in cases of a bankruptcy, and that way, because the people that are getting hurt the most are the workers who didn't get paid. I think that's sort of the basis of the lien laws to start with. Of course, I'm not an attorney, but it's my understanding of it anyway. So any other questions? Not seeing any. I was trying to think of another one, but I don't really have one. It seems pretty straightforward.
Chair Holvey, can I?
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this pretty common? I mean, you know, when a business goes under to leave the employees unpaid, and then this is part of also unemployment insurance. I think the employer pays into this fund. Is that correct? And so then all employers pay into this fund. It's pooled. And then for situations where businesses go under in this scenario where the employees aren't paid, then they step in and pay that and then try and get whatever they can from the business afterwards. But I guess the question is, how often did this happen? Quite a bit in the last few years when the economy was depressed?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, it happens fairly often, just depending on what business years are like. we get, essentially what happens is that an employee will file a wage claim with us, we'll contact the business, and when we're informed that the business has gone out of business, then we will move forward with getting the employee paid, verifying that they earned those wages and how much they earned. We haven't seen that it's been markedly worse, depending on sort of what the economy has been doing in the last few years.
Okay. Follow-up? The business if the economy is going along well, you don't have many businesses falling, then this fund would continue to get larger. Or if you recaptured that those losses from the businesses going under, this fund would get larger. Is this fund growing right now? Is it sustaining itself just by the returns? And then what happens if it gets larger? Does it get dispersed back into another fund?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I would say that it's maintaining right now. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily growing. It remains statutorily, it is the Wage Security Fund. It's a small portion of employment taxes that employers pay.
Thank you. And the priority for this fund would remain to fulfill that purpose of providing the benefit of wages to people who did not get paid what they were owed.
Chair Holvey, that's correct.
And currently, if Boley was able to utilize some more this fund and have more FTE, they would be able to recover more or address more complaints from workers that are having problems with recovering their money from employers.
Chair Holvey, that's correct.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Question? Not seeing any.
You got to answer.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2921? Not seeing anyone, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2921. Let's stand at ease. I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor. With that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2480.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure was before you on the 4th of February. It's the one that directs the OLCC to charge an application fee of $250 for issuance of new licenses. There are no amendments before you. There is a minimal fiscal impact, which means it did not rise to the level of issuing a full impact statement, and there is a revenue impact statement issued. And the measure goes to the floor. There is no subsequent referral.
Thank you.
Do you want a motion, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2480 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Barreto.
I remember this bill as having a $150 application fee, and that fee was to cover the cost of administrating the application. And then if you got the license, there was a $400 charge for the license. But that $150 fee was not passed on to help pay for that license. And that's the big struggle that I have with it. So instead of a $400 license, then it's a $550 license. So I think if that $150 was paid into the price of the permit, you know, then I could see it being a good bill. But as it is, I couldn't vote for it.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair, did I misunderstand OLCC wrong? Because I thought it went to, it wasn't in addition, it was just an upfront to the $450.
It is in addition to.
In addition to?
And there's somebody here from OLCC if you want to clarify.
Oh, with that, I
yeah.
Would
the OLCC like to come up?
If that's the case, I would be a no on this as well.
Thank you.
It is an addition.
I guess there were some questions. You heard the discussion about the $150 application fee and what kind of increase this really is. And as I recall, the agency came forward with this as something they needed to cover the cost of operations. So could you speak?
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I'm a policy analyst with the Liquor Commission. The fee is one-time fee, non-refundable, paid with the license application. The statute gives the OLCC authority to set the fee in rule up to $150. And so it is not credited against the license. It's a one-time fee in addition to the annual cost of the license. If there are any other clarifying questions, I'd be happy to address them.
What is the current fee?
The current, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, the current fee is variable by license type. It ranges between $100 and $400 annually.
And that's the for the applications?
Chair Holvey, that is the annual license fee. There is right. Currently no application fee.
So. Okay, thank you.
Representative
Hurd.
Chair Holvey, so
you can sit next to me too long.
Do we always take a vote on something like this, or do we? How does that work? Because I'm hearing folks expressing their vote.
Oh, we will take a vote.
Everything.
Quick question.
This is a moment for discussions. After a motion's been made, there's always time for discussion of the motion. Representative Nose.
Doesn't this bill kind of allow the allow us to operationalize House Bill 2731? I mean, isn't that kind of why we need this? These are the folks that were here asking to be able to sell, you know, their beverages to other states and allow other states to come in and sell their beverage. You know, it was kind of creating an open border system. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah.
Different bill.
Chair Holvey, Representative No, they are different bills. The bill before you now was brought at the request of the agency. 2731 was brought at the request of industry working with the agency, and I don't see really any overlap between the two bills.
Was the concern from the agency that the application process was losing money, and that's why they brought this fee forward?
Representative Holvey, unlike some other agencies, our fees are not designed to be self-funding for the agency. So the real gist of this was that we have approximately 6% of applicants begin a license application and never complete that application. The agency's feeling was by requiring a one-time application fee, that 6% of applicants who never complete the process could be reduced to a smaller number, and that would fill up, allow staff to fill their time and use their resources, devoting them to other license applications.
Thank you. Representative Widener, another question?
Yeah. Well, not so much a question, just a comment on this, because I have a full OLCC license and have been through the application process. I think is what happens with 6%, they get into it, or they might have issues where they run into, or they're opening a restaurant and things start falling through, or they find out they're not able to do it and everything. And I think that's why you have 6%, and to me that's a small amount. I didn't have a problem paying the $150 up front as long as that was going to my first year on the license, because I have to pay that $400 every year to keep that going. Mm-hmm. And the OLCC doesn't provide anything to me because I'm sending them that $400 check, other than every couple of years they'll send in a teenager to try and buy alcohol in the facility. So, and then we're paying that back through our taxes, so I don't see this as being necessary.
Thank you. Representative Hurd.
Does the OLCC at this point produce enough revenue to where it actually pumps money into the general fund?
Yes. Chair Holby, Representative Hurd, the OLCC is the state's third largest contributor to the general fund. We produce quite a lot of revenue for the general fund, principally through the sale of distilled spirits.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, again, I would agree with some of the other folks here at the committee. I'd be totally fine with this because I understand the accountability factor, but I would want to see it rolled into the current license fee rather than in addition. At that point, I would then have, I'd be in agreement with it, but as it is right now, I'm not.
Representative Doherty.
Well, with us, we had a lot of discussion, and I mean, we've been, any of us that own a business, we've gotten stuck for stuff where people have made, you know, this, oh, yes, we're going to go through and do this, and they don't. I mean, the important thing about it is if you've got 6% of people that start this, you do all the paperwork, and then they don't, and this is all for nothing, and then they go through and they don't follow through. I think it's very important to have that kind of accountability. And not only that, but realize this is a one-time shot, so it would only be rolled in rolled into the first license and not necessarily the rest of them. But, you know, when you put in a lot of time and effort and then all of a sudden somebody says, oh, changed my mind, I think there needs to be some sort of an accountability for that.
Thank you. Seeing any other comments on this? I do recognize that this is a fee increase, but also recognize that, you know, we try to make sure that the operations of agencies, you know, are supported by the people that use them. So that I'm comfortable taking. We've got a motion on the table. I don't see any other discussion. We have a roll call vote, please.
No.
Representative
Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Excused.
Vice Chair Chair Holman?
Aye. House Bill 2480 has passed. Anyone wishing to carry this bill on the floor?
No. Would you like me to do that?
Representative Doherty, thank you very much.
Come on, Paul.
With that, I'll that was good. Close the work session on House Bill 2480. While we're on the business of...
After our usual start.
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2481.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a measure that was before you on February 6th. It establishes a $50 fee to appeal the Board of Stewards ruling to the Oregon Racing Commission. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, but again, it didn't rise to the level of issuing a full impact statement.
Thank you.
Would you like a motion, Mr. Chair?
Certainly would.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2481 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2481 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on this one. Not seeing any discussion. Matthew, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Yes.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Representative
Excused.
Aye. Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Excused. Chair Holby? Aye. House Bill 2481, having received the required votes, is passed. Representative Hurd, would you like to carry this one on the floor?
Oh,
No.
Is that a yes? Did I hear it?
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Barreto, you bailed him out. I wasn't going to do that. But thank you, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Representative Barnetto.
Barnetto.
I did say Barreto this time.
Yeah, yeah, you did. You've done very well.
Pause every time he says it right.
Jeez. Did I close? I'll close the work session on House Bill.
Dancer Bill.
2481 yes. And open a work session on House Bill 2731.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure is for you on February 4th. It authorizes off-premises sales licensees to deliver malt beverages to retail customers. It also authorizes the holder of a direct shipper permit to ship malt beverage directly to Oregon customers. And it allows a brewer who's licensed in Oregon or another state to hold a direct shipper permit. There is the proposed amendment that was drafted after the committee meeting, and it adds a reciprocity clause by specifying that any out-of-state holder of the OLCC direct shipper permit may deliver the malt beverages to Oregon residents only if that other state also makes the direct shipper permits available for malt beverage deliveries to Oregon OLCC licensees. There is a fiscal impact statement. I think that you have a paper copy before you. We just brought it in this morning. Fiscal impact statement, and there is no revenue impact statement, and there is no subsequent referral on this measure.
However, do we have a request to send it to Ways and Means?
Ways and Means prepared the fiscal impact statement and looked at it and said that there was no need to send it to Ways and Means.
That's the final answer.
That's the final answer.
Okay, just double checking.
Oh, excuse me. Hold on. It's changed a number of times. Just right. Excuse me. It's been back and forth.
That's why I was double checking.
Yes. Yes. Ways and Means, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. They would like a Ways and Means referral on this bill. So when it was originally sent to the committee, there was no Ways and Means subsequent referral requested. But after they prepared the fiscal impact, they did request it. So my apologies.
Not a major concern, I don't think. But I think it's appropriate to send this to Ways and Means. So... you prepared for that motion?
Yes, certainly. First, we're going to adopt dash ones, Mr. Chair, and once assuming
that's correct,
that, then we'll move it to Ways and Means. So,
correct.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2731.
Representative Barton moves to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2731. Discussion? Not seeing any. Is there any objection? Not seeing any. The dash one amendment is adopted.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2731 as amended to the floor at the due pass recommendation and add a referral to the Joint Committee.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2731 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a referral be added to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Discussion? Seeing any discussion, can we have a vote, please? Matthew?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Eskimo?
Excuse.
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kennebert?
Excused. Aye. House Bill 2731 is referred to the Joint Committee Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2731. Open a work session on House Bill 2213.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this was before you on February 13th. It makes on-the-job safety issues an employment relation subject to collective bargaining for the employees of the Department of Corrections who have direct contact with inmates. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact, but no fiscal statement was issued, and there is no subsequent referral on this measure.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Mm-hmm. Representative Hurd.
Does it have a sunset somewhere in it?
No,
I received a question from another member, so that's why I'm asking.
No sunset.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Representative Barreto.
My understanding is this is just for the use of bargaining, that they are in a more dangerous situation, and so this is just an aspect in their bargaining process which they haven't had before. Is that correct?
I believe so. We could have Mr. Dempsey come up if he would to make sure that I'm answering this correctly, proponent of the bill.
Absolutely. Chair Hovey, Jack Dempsey, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. Representative Barreto, that is correct.
Follow up.
It
seems, this has been going on for a long time. Has this bill been presented before and failed, or is this just all of a sudden they recognize that they're in a dangerous situation and we need to do something about it?
Yeah, this is the first, Chair Hovey, Representative Barreto, this is the first time that this has been presented. Being able to bargain over safety issues just came, I believe, back on the books in 2007, and that was just for sworn folks at that time, which includes corrections officers. So I guess it was a recent recognition that this needs to get expanded to include non-sworn folks in corrections but have that work in just as dangerous a settings as corrections officers do.
So basically everyone that works inside the prison in whatever capacity has this opportunity to use this then in their bargaining, as long as they are union employed, or are they all union employed?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, all of the folks that work in our Oregon prisons are union employees. So this would just cover folks that have contact with inmates. So there are folks that work for corrections that don't have contact with inmates, I'm assuming somewhere. So this is mainly the folks that work in prisons that do.
All right.
Right. I think that was the clarifier. They had to have direct contact with the prisoners. Representative Nose.
I would just add for my colleagues, if you don't have experience with collective bargaining, all it says is we get to talk about this. Right. It doesn't require the employer to reach an agreement, right? Both sides still have to talk it out and try to figure it out. But at least with this, we get to put it on the table and actually at least have the discussion.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dempsey, this is essentially to get after employees that have contact to make sure safety regulations and things are followed, or so they can negotiate to make sure they're protected when they're in a situation with inmates.
Yes.
Yeah, Chair Holby, Representative Widener, absolutely.
And to bring that to the attention of management.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative, you're good. Thank you, Mr. Dempsey. Appreciate it. Any other discussion? Seeing no other discussion, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Dougherty?
Aye.
Representative Eskimo?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Byrd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenimer?
Excused.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2213, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. And Representative Evans, would you like to take a crack at carrying this on the floor?
I will try not to mess it up too badly. Yes.
We would appreciate that. So with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2213.
It's a bill I understand.
That's the money.
More to come. Oh, we're not done with these motions.
I would like to open a work session for introduction of committee bills.
Chair Holby, I move the following two legislative concepts to be adopted as introduced as committee bills. LC 3648, dated February 13th, 2015, and LC 3657, dated February 18th, 2015. Move they be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Barton moves LC 3648, dated February 13th, 2015, and LC 3657, dated February 18th, 2015, be introduced as committee bills. Committee members, this, again, does not reflect that you either oppose or support these measures. It is simply a our process for bringing a bill to a conversation in the legislature, perhaps. Is there any objection? Any other discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And with that, I will close the work session. And anything else on your agenda, Jan? Good of the order from anyone? Seeing none, thank you very much. We will close the adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.